So that really kind of does lead into the whole story of the patients who go to surgery first, and you alluded, which I'm really curious to hear you talk a little bit more about, at least how in Europe the regulatory groups have kind of responded to this. But again, can you talk a little bit about the way you approach the patient who's going for primary debulking surgery and how you decide what you're going to be doing post-op?
So the patient who goes for primary debulking surgery, we will only use bevacizumab if they've either got stage four disease, let's say pleural effusion, or that they have had unsuccessful surgery. And by that, I mean that they've got more than 2 centimeters of residual disease. So those patients we would use, and we are funded to use bevacizumab. Now, at that point, of course, this is the difficulty that we're going to run into. If that patient turns out to have a BRCA mutation, we would rather not give the patient bevacizumab, but wait until she's had the 6 cycles of chemotherapy and then put in olaparib. So to do that, we would have to get the results of that BRCA mutation analysis very quickly before we make that decision, latest, you know, really cycle two, cycle three of the post-operative chemotherapy, so that we can actually maximize the effectiveness of bevacizumab or not give it so that we give olaparib. It's slightly easier in the neoadjuvant population because if we work to the principle that maybe we don't need to give bevacizumab for the first 2 cycles because it's not going to do very much, we've got time to wait for the BRCA mutation analysis at cycle three to know after surgery whether or not we now introduce the bevacizumab or we wait till cycle six and introduce olaparib.
As you know, we really love asking people clinical scenario questions and kind of see what they do. We ask investigators, we have docs in practice. And one of the things I've noticed more in the recurrent setting, but it's just kind of an interesting idea, is I'm starting to see a bunch of people, not the majority, you know, maybe 20% of docs, talk about, and again, this is more in a recurrent setting, but I kind of wonder about it even in the upfront setting, using carboplatin and Bev for the 6 cycles, then stopping the Bev and adding a PARP inhibitor maintenance. Any thoughts about that strategy?
Well, if you look at the results of GOG-218, there was an arm that had bevacizumab with chemotherapy and then placebo maintenance. And that arm did no better than the placebo arm in terms of progression-free survival. So I don't think that really makes sense from the point of view of improving progression-free survival. Where you could argue there might be benefit is if you've got a patient with bulky disease at the end of her surgery, you will get an 18% to 20% higher response rate for whatever that's worth, because it doesn't translate into a progression-free survival benefit if you give them bevacizumab with chemotherapy and then stop. So I don't think that really, as progression-free survival is, although an endpoint with problems of itself, is a stronger endpoint than response rate, I don't think there's much value in giving bevacizumab with chemotherapy and then stopping. And really, it's, you know, if you're doing that just because you haven't had a chance to test for the BRCA mutation, I don't think that's probably the best way to practice. What you need to do is to develop the logistics so that you can get the BRCA mutation analysis quickly and make that decision early.
So as you said, these things are all sort of bubbling around, and you know, a bunch of trials are going to be reported. Incidentally, the Paola study, is that going to be presented this year at ESMO, or we don't know?
I think it's likely that it'll come to ESMO. I mean, what I've heard is that it's likely to come to ESMO, yes.